Well, we've chatted a number of times, and the last time you were in, it was a couple of years ago, I think you had written one of the Levette novels. And
it's a lot of years ago.
Yeah.
Time passes.
And you were telling me some wonderful stories. And I said to you, I said, you know, I know you've fictionalized a lot of your material, but you've lived such a colorful life that you really ought to think about doing a memoir. And you said, nah. No, I don't think so. You said, everything I've done, it's been reflected in my fiction. And I said, I know, you can do different things with fiction, that's true. Capitalize on your experiences, but you really ought to do a memoir. And he said, well, I'll think about it. So I think I have a certain degree of conceit in taking a certain degree of credit for this memoir.
You can take all the credit, as a matter of fact. I don't know whether I regret this or not, but until I did it, I knew it would be in there and waiting, pleading to get out. Now it's out. I'm rid of it. With the book and the reviews, I'm taking my last passage and red baiting, and it's strange, but it lingers on. It lingers on. It will not go away. The review in the New York Times this coming Sunday, I don't know whether it's this coming Sunday when this is released, but a review by Maurice Isserman doubts things, I say. Says that can't be true. Fast has lost his memories, dreaming. No. One of the results of having the FBI practically living in our house and with me wherever I went, was that I documented everything. I have enormous files, and everything is in my files. I say nothing in that book that I cannot prove with material from my files. So,
You did go to use the Freedom of Information Act, didn't you, to get your FBI file?
I got them, but they were of no use to me, because there were 1,100 pages, and all you could say of it is that it was a commentary on the stupidity and the ignorance of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington. If I wanted a testimony from my grandchildren, I'd say, here's something to prove that your grandfather didn't live his life in vain. I give them this 1,100 pages from the FBI. Every speech I made in behalf of the poor, every time I walked a picket line and a plant that was struck, every time I spoke in civil rights causes, every time I spoke for the blacks, every time I was in the South walking picket lines, every decent act of my life is in the FBI files. With half of the 1,100 pages blacked out, because those were the names and reports of the spies they had in the party. But the stupidity, which is typical of the way so many government agencies work. Back in those years, I don't remember the exact year, I was asked to do an American diary for a Vienna newspaper. I did this diary in about 30 parts. I guess it amounted to about 20,000, 30,000 words, maybe. Printed in German, in a newspaper in Vienna. The FBI ordered their Vienna agent to pick up all the copies of the newspaper and get them back here. Then, back here, they translated. See, in these 1,100 pages, there were the German translation. Then they retranslated it into English so that J. Edgar Hoover and his boys would know what I was talking about. So they have the English translation there. Then they hired an expert, a college professor, to compare the German to the English to make sure they were getting the real product. The whole process must have cost them $1 million, at least. All they had to do was call me and ask for the page. I would have gladly given to them, no secrets there. But this crazy spy business that they went through, well, 1,100 pages.
It really is incredible. And the interesting thing about your participation in the Communist Party, you really didn't hide it. I mean, you wrote a weekly column for the Daily Record.
Right. I made no secret of it. But all through the book, you see the contradictions between what I wrote and what I knew and what was given out by Washington, much wider arena. I think the story of the atom bomb in there, of when the Russians got the bomb, is the most interesting thing. I don't have the exact dates at hand, but it's in there. And Professor Frederick Joliot Curie was here in New York. I asked him whether the Russians had the bomb. He said, it's no secret. They have already 5 bombs, or they're making 2 every month, something like that. I went to the Daily Worker. I said, how do we handle this? They decided that since Curie was not giving a press interview or anything, they just run it as a casual report. I was at the party, and Joliot Curie said this to me. 3 years later, the feds announced that the Russians have the bomb. Now, this is the kind of thing that I ran into constantly. It wasn't that we were doing terrible things. It was that they couldn't even find out innocent things. The ineptness of that whole huge FBI apparatus.
And apparently this reflected J. Edgar Hoover's paranoia, didn't it?
I think he was totally mad. Totally mad. There's no other explanation for it. And the interesting thing is that they probably, by the time I left the party in 1956 or 7, they must have had maybe 2,000 agents in the Communist Party eating up the taxpayers' money for nothing.
Gee, by that time there were more agents than communists.
Well, you know, a friend of mine, Eddie Anholt, was in Moscow working on that joint venture of Peter the Great. You remember the TV that the Russians cooperated in? And Eddie was writing the script, making changes that went in. Every day he had a KGB man who kept pace with him all the time. Eddie got to know him. They became very friendly. He said, why on earth are you following me? You know what I do here. I'm a writer. I'm working on a joint picture. KGB man says, that's my instructions. I got to follow you. Eddie said, why? He said, well, you don't understand. Every year the KGB asks for more money. Justify asking for more money, we must put on additional agents. And we've got so many agents that we don't know what to do with them. So they give me the job of following you.
I guess there's a parallel here then, isn't there? But there was, after the war, a great fear of the Soviet Union, that it was a mortal enemy, and that the communists in this country reflected their viewpoint. And remember the Bay of Pigs about 1962, something like 63, something like that? I was so sure there was going to be a war. I was working at a little radio station in Pennsylvania. I went out and I bought a hunting knife, and I put that in the trunk of my car because I was sure I was going to have to engage in hand-to-hand combat with the Russians when they landed on our shores. I know that was very naive and stupid, but there was that feeling that we were going to have war with the Soviet Union and that the communists in this country were their agents.
Well, what can one say? That was when Khrushchev put the atom bombs in Cuba, and it felt like the end of the world. The point is that Hitler, with the greatest war machine ever assembled, and a very professional and good war machine, couldn't cross the English Channel. No hope of it. So the thought of the Russians landing on our shores with what? They'd have to walk on water. And the Russians in World War II lost 20 million people. 20 million people. It's a hard number to realize. Today, we see the result of that war and of the Soviet system, which is far from being an intelligent way to conduct life. The result is that it's a powerless nation, it's fragmenting, it's disintegrating, and from day to day, nobody knows the future of the Soviet Union. Now, partly because these seeds of destruction were there, the Soviet Union wanted peace. They pleaded for peace. They backed every peace movement in the world. The thought of the Soviet Union conducting another war after World War II, inconceivable. Why didn't our intelligence people know that?
I don't know. It just seemed to be a common feeling that at some point we were going to have war with the Russians. I mean, this was a feeling that almost everybody, except people like yourself.
But it was a nurtured feeling.
Yeah.
It was a very carefully nurtured feeling.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about intelligence. We're supposed to have a great CIA intelligence organization. Why didn't they ask someone what the temperature is in Saudi Arabia in the summer? I've been there. I put the temperature down in that book. It goes above 140 degrees in the shade. I saw that with my own eyes. Why the hell didn't our great intelligence organization know that? Why didn't they know that the fine sand would make it almost impossible for many of our machines to function there? I mean, what does intelligence mean? If they were playing these lunatic games with the KGB, and giving a whole breed of third-rate American writers an opportunity to write these silly spy novels that flooded us in those years, you know, 20, 30, 50 every year, I can't think of any other function that they had. And now, of course, the Soviet spy novel has gone the way of all flesh.
No, that's really tough for these spy writers now. They have to create villains, since the Russians are on our side now.
Yes. I don't think the Russians are on any side. I think they're barely fighting for survival.
Let's talk about some of the things in Being Read, this memoir, wonderful memoir that you wrote. I had no idea that you had such a brutal childhood. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, today we have a great deal of poverty in the United States. We have food stamps. We have welfare. We have free medical help, badly run, badly apportioned, but we have free medical help. We have a number of other things. When I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, when my mother died, there was no welfare. There was no free medical aid of any kind. There were no food stamps. If you didn't have the money to buy your food, you starved. No one fed you. When the Depression came, none of those things were around. Well, I had the misfortune at the age of 8 to lose a wonderful mother. And I had a father, a lovely human being, but never again could get it together. And the result was I had three little boys and we were on our own. My grandmother took my young brother, the writer you've met, I think, but my older brother, a year older than I, and I were left to do for ourselves. from, well, my sister stayed, an older sister stayed with me for a year, stayed with the family, then she went off.
You became kind of a street kid, didn't you?
Well, there were two of us. Yeah. No mother, no one to take care of us. My father, what energy he had, went to trying to make a living. So I grew up on the streets. I lived on the streets. I began to work. The two of us began to work when I was 10 and my brother was 11. Got work delivering the Bronx Home News, which was a great blessing. And from age 10 and a half on, I worked.
You worked in the library, too.
I worked in a library. I worked for a cigar manufacturer. I worked in a butcher shop. I worked for a hat maker.
I can see philosophically why you might be drawn to the left as you became older.
Well, I think I was born with the left inside of me. I can hardly remember a time when I wasn't thinking that way. But it was a time when the left, you know, today people say we're in a recession that may, if we're very unlucky, turn into a depression, a real depression. But in what they call the Great Depression, it's a hell of a word, great, but in the time of the Great Depression, unlike today, today there are a great many poor, enormous number of poor in the United States. We have developed a kind of a European underclass. Also a great many well-to-do, rich, and comfortable people. In 1929, when the Depression began, no one had money as it unfolded. Today, a great many people have money. I was talking to a man who operates a string of big stores. He had opened the store in Detroit and was making huge profits. I said, how the hell, this is a toy store, how the hell can a toy store make money in Detroit? The city is a ruin. 20% of the people in the city are out of work. How can a store? He said, but 80% are doing very well. It's the 80% who patronize my store, not the 20%. It's a very interesting situation that nobody talks much about today. At the time of the Depression, this didn't exist. The 80% it was reversed. There may have been 20% who had money, never saw them, but there were 80% who were broke. And the difference was that some were more broke than others.
But there was also a very wide middle class. And my mother and father were resolutely middle class, middle westerners. They were not rich and they weren't poor. And in fact, my family today is very much like they were in the 1930s.
They were lucky.
Yeah,
I have met people my age said, I didn't know there was a depression in those days. We had enough food. We lived in the same place. My father kept working. It's true. But for an enormous number of the people, it was stark poverty.
Well, back to the memoir. There was an interesting section. Want some water?
No, that's all.
You began writing short stories, and you were writing them longhand and sending them out. Tell me about that.
Well, I knew so little. I was such an innocent that the first half dozen stories I wrote in longhand, sent them out. Either they disappear or I get them back. No word, nothing. Finally, an editor was kind enough to write me a letter and say, no one will read a longhand story, especially since my longhand was nothing to write home about. I was a left-handed boy in those days in our schools, where a certain amount of barbarism prevailed. If you were left-handed, you were forced to write right-handed. And writing was taught by what they called the Palmer Method, the form of torture, unbelievable torture. You had to write with your whole arm, with your whole arm motion, and you would sit in class and cover sheets of paper with circles, which was meant to gain control of the whole onion. Ask anyone my age, ask anyone in their 70s, and they'll tell you about the horrors of the Palmer method.
Oh, I want to tell you, my father is quite a bit older than you are. He's in his 80s, but he was a lefty, and he was compelled by his teacher, who would slap him with a ruler,
yep,
to write. And to this day, he now writes with both hands, almost as equally as well. And it was
exactly.
So, last time I saw him, last July, he was telling me about this, and he said it was so traumatic for him, and he hates bitterly this teacher who did this to him.
And well, if you use your left hand, they'd hit it.
Right.
You know what they called the left hand? The devil's hand. Now you leave the devil's hand alone, let the devil have it. You write with your right hand. Result was that my writing never became much better than a scrawl. It was a horrible thing. So anyway, it was a difficult environment. But you know, I never had a sense of being poor because we ate. We ate and we had a place to sleep. Poor was the army of people at the edge of the river who had no place to sleep and nothing to eat, and they slept in shacks and cardboard boxes and all of that. And they were omnipresent. You saw them wherever you went, wherever there was a lot or a clear piece of land in the city. It was covered with these shacks and the people sleeping. So we never felt that we were poor. It's only looking back that the condition of poverty just overwhelms me.
Back to your writing. I think you write in Being Read that your family got together enough cash to buy you a typewriter.
To rent one.
Huh?
Must have been about $1 a month or something like that. Everything was very cheap then.
And you taught yourself to type?
Yeah, two fingers, which I still do. No, it was not until my wife and I were married that we invested. One of the first investments we made out of the little bit of cash we got for being married was a 37 Underwood. We were married in 1937. And we bought a 1937 Underwood, which is unquestionably the greatest machine ever created by American ingenuity. And I had to give it up, what was it, 3-4 years ago, because the scavenging for parts, but if you know...
Did you use that Underwood since 1937 up to 3 years ago?
Up to 3 years. And ask any old newspaper man, and he will tell you that there never was a machine that equaled that 1937 Underwood. Magnificent machine. I had to replace it, unfortunately, with the Olympia, which is a German machine and almost as good. See? I always said to myself, how can I write on a German machine?
You were 18 when you sold your first novel, weren't you?
18. 17 when I sold my first story.
You were a very precocious young man.
Well, I just didn't have time for childhood. Yeah, I suppose I was precocious.
But a novel at the age of 18, that's so hard to do and to sell once you've done it.
And you know, I sold it to one of the most distinguished publishing houses in the country, the Dial Press, the old Dial Press, which in 1932 or 3, when Roosevelt went into the White House for his first term, he made the president of the Dial Press his ambassador to Greece, whereupon the Dial Press closed it down, put it out for sale, and that was the end of the Dial Press. So it was one of the last books ever published by the old Dial Press.
Well, you went on to publish two or three more books. I guess that gave you some credentials to work for the War Information Office.
The Office of War Information, yeah. That was an interesting
thing. And you actually were the first person to work for the Voice of America.
Well, in a sense, I created the Voice of America. I gave it its little jingle at that time, Yankee Doodle. The announcer sit down and say, this is the voice of America. You see, this was the only voice into occupied Europe. At that point, all of Europe was occupied. We had no medium wave sending apparatus that could reach Europe. We had to make a deal with the Brits, and they gave us the BBC network for
4 hours.
4 hours. Yeah. And in that 4 hours, we broadcast in every language of occupied Europe.
And you wrote the basic show.
I wrote that each show was 15 minutes, and I laid out and wrote the 15-minute basic show that went out in English and was translated into, I think it was like 14 languages or whatever. I did it. I don't think I realized at the time what I was doing, the importance, the meaning of what I was doing. And it was a wonderful experience.
But you really wanted to go overseas as a war correspondent, didn't you?
Well, when we moved into North Africa and established ourselves in North Africa, into 1944, the BBC said to us, now, you've got North Africa, give us our 4 hours back. And we began to build in North Africa a medium wave transmitting station. And the Voice of America would then be moved to North Africa, where with medium wave it could cover most of Europe. See, and at that point, that was the beginning of Red Bay. I was not a party member. I was not a communist. I had nothing to do with it. But in this collection of actors, very fine actors, who, see, when I wrote this 15-minute daily broadcast, I would break it to three voices, voice one, voice two, voice three. So we'd have it read by three actors so that there could be a tonal difference, which made it a little more interesting. And a number of these actors were communists. So the FBI, knowing about this, let out the word that I was a Red because I was working with these communist actors, whom I did not know at the time were communists. This is what I was told later. So when the time came for me to go over to North Africa and continue my work, and I think, as I say in the book, Betty was pregnant then, and we were ready to have the child born in an army hospital in North Africa, I was told that I was a Red and I would not issue any passport.
But you eventually did get credentials.
I only got credentials at the time when Wallace was vice president, and by appealing directly to Wallace, I was giving a limited 3-month passport. But when I returned, they took that away from me. Never gave it to me again.
Well, that was those were harrowing adventures that you had in those 3 months, and lot of it is reflected in your novel, The Pledge, and taking you into India. It's really interesting. Matter of fact, the last time you were here, you told me the most wonderful story. You were on a plane, and I think one of the engines conked out, and the pilot had to dive sharply to bring the engine back, and it was lightning outside, and there was a young man in the blue light of this plane reading a book.
Marvelous story.
It was a wonderful story, and I was delighted to see that you got it in the memoir. It was a wonderful story.
I should have known, because what my life was came out of books. Without the New York Public Library, I would be nothing. I couldn't exist. In a piece I did for Newsday, I recalled how Jimmy Baldwin had talked to me about this when we had dinner one evening, and we agreed that both of us were created by the New York Public Library system. Now, in that story you mentioned, to see this kid in this harrowing experience holding this book up to the little blue blackout light in the plane, and then to talk to him afterwards and find out that before he went in the army, he had never read a book. This kid from Tennessee. Since he was in the army, it existed only to read. The war meant nothing else to him. The war was an opportunity to read. It's a fascinating story. I don't want to go into the whole thing because that'll take away whatever time we have.
Yeah, we are running short. I did want to cover, because we have a few more years to cover, but after the war you wrote some very highly regarded novels, The American and a whole, I mean, there's so many in your list here. It's something like 70 books, Freedom Road and Citizen Tom Paine and all these wonderful books that put you in high literary stead. You joined the Communist Party, and where you got into trouble, as I learned by being read, was that you were a board member of a group to help the refugees in Spain.
Yeah.
Now tell me how this landed you in the lap of the House and American Activities Committee.
Well, when the Spanish War... The Spanish Civil War was over. The anti-Franco forces, a great many of them, fled across the Pyrenees to Toulouse in the south of Spain. And wounded, sick, all sorts of medical problems. So we got together with those of us who had supported the War of the Republicans in Spain. We got together with the Unitarians and the Society of Friends, the Quakers. And we raised the money to buy an old convent in Toulouse, very good building. And we set up a hospital there. And I visited this convent. It was a good modern hospital. And we gave free medical service to the Republicans who had fought in the Spanish Republican Army against Franco and to their families. And it cost a great deal of money. It ran into millions of dollars, and we raised that money here. And I was on the board of this group who raised the money. Now, we were very wide because the feeling in America for the Spanish Republic and for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which had fought for the Republic in Spain, was very wide. In spite of the half-crazed anti-communism, that existed and continued, and we continued to raise money. But Mrs. Roosevelt gave us money. Mrs. Lehman, the governor's wife, gave us money. Loads of people who were in the headlines, who were important, conservative, establishment people, gave us money. And they were listed in our books for their contributions. The FBI knew this, and they subpoenaed the books. And we had a meeting, the board of directors, and we decided that we could not surrender these names. So when we were called down to Washington by the Un-American Committee and asked whether we had the books with us, we said, no, we didn't bring the books. They said, your books were subpoenaed. Why didn't you bring them? We didn't bring them. Cited for contempt of Congress.
You had an explosive interchange with the committee members, didn't you?
Yes, yes.
Because you were a man known for a rather fiery temper anyway.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
And still are. I mean, you're not afraid, never were afraid to call a spade a spade.
But I'm mellowed.
I mean, well, you've even when you left the Daily Worker, I mean, you were calling the shots as you saw them.
Well, now I do a column, a weekly column for the New York Observer, and they let me write as I please. And when the Gulf thing began, I was the only columnist on the first day who denounced it and said it was a phony gasoline war, an oil war, and nothing for any American kid to die for. And I go on, I write as I please. Much fewer limitations than I had on the Daily Worker. I can write a hell of a lot more freely for the New York Observer than I ever could for the Daily Worker.
I know, but the Communist Party did have a line to follow. Isn't that true? They had a structure, a philosophy, then everybody was to adapt to it.
When they asked me to do a daily column, I said, I'll do it if I can call the column I write as I please. Big, big discussion. And no way, no, we will not. Where the hell does he get off saying he writes as he pleases? We can't do that in the communist paper. So, no, no column. I will only write under that thing. Well, finally they agreed. But while they agreed, they made my life miserable. Because while I wrote as I pleased, they felt they had the right to change as they pleased. And it did not work nearly as well as these days on The Observer. I've been working for The Observer now for almost, well, I guess well over a year. They've never changed a word.
How many times in when you were a communist did they threaten to bring you up on charges?
Half a dozen times at least.
Threatened with expulsion.
Let me say this about the Communist Party. The Communist Party is an impossible organization. It was a brainchild of Lenin. And Lenin's need and desire, he felt that in World War I, every socialist party had betrayed the working people and gone to wars. Well, true, they had. So he was going to create a party mechanism that could not betray the working people. And he called this the dictatorship of the proletariat, meaning that within this party representing the working people, there would be a structure, a sort of a dictatorship, so that it could function as a dictatorship over whoever was against the revolution or the working class. And he set up a mechanism that became not a dictatorship over the non-revolutionary people, it became a dictatorship over the workers and over its own members and over everyone else, so that every communist party following this Leninist schematic, wherever it was on earth, turned into a rigid, unbending dictatorship which put an end to free thought, it put an end to free action, put an end to all of this. Now, at the same time, it drew the allegiance of everyone who dreamed of socialism. So you had this terrible contradiction, because the various socialist parties made their peace with the other parties, and the only party that rigidly fought for the position of socialism was the Communist Party, and in so doing, it destroyed the argument for socialism, it destroyed the structure of socialism, and the result today, which we see, is a world which says socialism failed. Socialism didn't fail. Socialism was never tried. What they created in the Soviet Union had as little resemblance to socialism as General Motors.
So, Howard, we're going to have to speed up a little bit because we're really almost out of time. But 1950, for contempt of Congress, you were sent to prison. You were in prison for 3 months. Looking back at that period, are you holding any sense of bitterness now?
No. No. I think every writer should have a term in prison. I think it teaches a thing. War and prison must be experienced. I don't think either of them can be taught. And prison teaches something that no amount of study and no amount of argument can do. And above all things, what prison teaches a sensitive human being is that the prison system is barbaric. It belongs to the past. It does nothing. It solves nothing. And the whole notion, this whole primitive notion of punishment as we apply it is worthless. Furthermore, if we keep building prisons, we will not continue as a democratic nation. You know, this statistic, what is it, that 20% of black youth between the age of 18 and 20 is in prison? I mean, this is, oh my, if the statistic is somewhat like that, it's mind-shattering. We can't live with that kind of thing.
You have to do something about the drug problem. That's what has caused it. It's just out of control. But to get back on track a little bit, after you were released, you were asked to run for Congress in the Bronx, and that really did take a certain degree of conceit, didn't it?
I learned a great deal. I got a disease which is called candidatitis. And this disease takes hold of your mind, and it convinces you that your winning an election is important, very often the most important thing on earth. And it grips you to a point where you're ready to kill to win that election. So I went through that. I was soundly defeated. But it was a fascinating experience, absolutely fascinating experience. And I'm glad I went through it. Now my daughter-in-law is running for a state post in Connecticut. And I wish her the best.
Well, you found that after it became known about your communist ties and your prison term and so forth, it was almost impossible for you to find a publisher. You started your own press with a strangely ironic name, the Blue Heron Press. Wonderful, wonderful name. I have a number of those Blue Heron books that you...
Well, a friend of mine said you publish the book yourself, you got to call it the Red Herring Press. I said, come on, you don't call it the Red Herring Press. Said, well, how about the Blue Herring? We ended up with the Blue Herring. That's a normal departure from the Red Herring. And I published it myself. That was Spartacus. It was a tremendous success, tremendous bestseller, and finally became a film.
And still being read.
Still being read and reprinted constantly, read in great numbers, yes.
Fascinating that Spartacus, one of your best-known books, maybe your best-known book, is still being published today, and you could not find someone to publish it at the time that you wrote it. It's just incredible. The memoir ends approximately 1957, I believe, in that area. But it would be interesting to find out how you were able to overcome the antagonism of the publishers towards your work, and you're back on track. And have, since that time, you've written maybe 20, 30 other books. You have certainly Houghton Mifflin is one of the best publishers in the country. It'd be interesting to tell that story, because you mentioned at the end of being read that your relationship with Betty was a traumatic thing because of all the things you were doing and all the activity. It'd be interesting to find out how you reconciled all these problems and how you...
You really think so? I mean, sir, you really think this? Because I've played with the thought.
You need a companion volume to this.
You think so?
Well, I told you that you needed this one, and you did it. Was I wrong?
I don't know. It hasn't been published yet. I don't know when this is going over the air, but today is the 31st. We're still 9 days short of publication, of the publication date, which is November 9th. And it's selling very well, selling very nicely. But that's a very interesting thought.
Well, your life didn't end in 1957. It goes on, and your life was still one of activity. And also, just some literary thoughts. I mean, how you work, we know a lot about how you get your ideas, but how does a writer fulfill it? And, I mean, I'd like to find out more about that.
Do you know, Don, this is a very strange thing. The Houghton Mifflin books. Houghton Mifflin became my publisher in 76. 1976. That's 14 years ago. The books I wrote for them in those 14 years have sold 14 million copies. That's quite a figure. And I don't write what is it, Judy Carroll, Judy Collins writes. I don't write what the spy novelists write. These are serious social books where I deal with social problems and preach a bit and teach a bit and all the rest of it. Now, before this 15 million, my book sold astronomically. Freedom Road, I once was able to estimate that worldwide over 30 million copies of Freedom Road were printed. So with all this, I became, and I'm old enough to say it now, one of the most beloved writers in a host of countries, not only the United States, but Spain, Italy, some of the Scandinavian countries. But in the United States, a beloved writer with a vast audience, the most hated writer in the history of this country. No writer, not only in my time, no writer, as far as I've been able to explore history, has been the recipient of the amount of venom and hatred that was flung at me. No writer of our times, I think, has been as beloved as I am. Now, that's a very neat experience, which I try to deal with.